Imagine a woman with an enormous pregnant stomach doing a body roll on stage in a transparent shimmering robe, her belly a glowing gold disco ball. The woman slowly shimmies out of her dress, uncovering her breasts, then her baby bump, gazing coyly at the audience as she reveals a flirty set of lingerie. The next moment, she jumps into the splits. To close the number, she removes her bra with her back turned to the audience, then spins around dramatically to reveal a set of tassels over her breasts, which she begins whirling in a circular motion before ending her number by blowing a drawn-out kiss to the audience. Meet Satira Tewin, a 31-year-old burlesque performer and teacher who lives with her now 1-year-old son Declan and husband Eric in Portland, Oregon. I met Satira last year while looking for moms to talk to about an idea that has been plaguing me for some time, that in order to be a good mom, you have to give up an important part of yourself, your sexuality. I'm Donna Cleveland, and this is the second episode of Women and Radio, a podcast that explores how the beliefs we hold shape women's lives. In the first episode, we looked at why women are still stuck doing the bulk of housework in America. If you can relate to this problem and you haven't listened to it yet, I highly recommend you check it out. In this episode, we'll explore who this fictional woman is that I've since learned many women believe they must become once they have a baby. To some, Satira's dance may seem like lighthearted fun. To others, it may even seem inappropriate. To me, it felt defiant, which I admired.
It's just not common for people to think that pregnant women are sexy. But I'm over here like, hey, I'm still a super babe. I'm just as sexy as ever. I just have a big old belly. And they see me, they're like, oh my gosh, pregnancy is beautiful and sexy. I'm still as fabulous as ever. I think the audience sees that and it probably just makes them think about pregnant women a little bit differently.
Satira said she also planned to help people think a little differently about women after they've had their baby.
Unfortunately, the idea is that moms are not sexy. All of a sudden you become a mom and you're just like a mom. And the sexy part of your life suddenly is supposed to just disappear and you're just supposed to take care of this other person, which I think is terrible.
Before Satira ever became pregnant, she was already used to having to assert her right to feel good about herself. Growing up, Satira said her mom put a lot of pressure on her to be thin. When Satira joined burlesque, it brought the issue to a head.
When I did first start performing and she found out, one of the things that she said, she was like, well, you need to lose weight if you're going to do that.
Wow. How did that make you feel?
I mean, it didn't make me feel good, but it wasn't an uncommon thing to hear. I'm Asian, and Asian people tend to be smaller. My family made me feel like I should be thinner, and I love them. They didn't, like, do this on purpose. It's just kind of like the way Cambodian culture was, but that certainly shaped my lack of confidence while I was growing up, which, of course, was still there when I became an adult. I felt a lot of shame about my belly fat. So, like, doing burlesque and not being, like, a super thin person, I did have to, like, get through that. When I first started performing, I always covered my belly. I mean, I guess that didn't stay too long because then I was like, woo, I like being free. This is great.
After years of performing, Satira is now a headmistress at a burlesque school in Portland, where she helps guide other people through the same process of gaining confidence that she went through.
It's just very empowering. Being a burlesque performer has made me a much more accepting person of myself. Seeing people of all shapes and sizes, feeling sexy and removing their clothes and being proud of themselves, I think that is just a wonderful thing. So I love doing it and I love sharing it and teaching it to other people even more.
Talking to Satira gave me a glimpse of a refreshing new model of motherhood, different from the one I'd been holding onto in my head. I've always assumed I'd have kids at some point in my life. I figured that when the time was right, my fears would melt away and a feeling of readiness would replace them. But as the years roll on and my hangups don't seem to be going anywhere, I'm beginning to wonder if that's true. So much about motherhood both draws me in and repels me. The love I can imagine having for a new little being makes it feel totally worthwhile. Even though the thought of giving birth and of losing so many nights of sleep terrifies me. But when I stop and think about what bothers me most, it comes down to this feeling that I'll have to become a different person in order to be a good mother. I thought it would be helpful to put some words to this image of motherhood I had in my head. Here's what I came up with. Nurturing, modest, sweet, domestic, self-sacrificing. Oh, and definitely not stylish. In particular, I've assumed that a woman's sexuality goes through a huge transformation when she becomes a mom. I know there are many practical reasons why a new mom might not be feeling particularly sexy, including fatigue, postpartum depression, or limited resources, since let's face it, kids are expensive. However, in this episode, we'll be focusing on the external messages that society sends us about what a mother should be. If you look to the media, it's easy to find examples that match this image. Take Saturday Night Live's Mom Jeans skit, for example. Mom jeans. Tina Fey and Rachel Dratch frolic around in unflattering pants.
Cut generously to fit a mom's body.
This brutal line sums up what we think of a mom's sex appeal.
Give her something that says, I'm not a woman anymore. I'm a mom.
When talking to Satira, she had a hard time pinning down a reason why we look at moms in this light.
Some people might be like, oh, that body made a person and now it has all these flaws. Or it could just be like the way moms are portrayed in the media and stuff. It's like, okay, they're not sexy. They're usually like doing stuff to like take care of a baby. Mm-hmm. Or like a soccer mom thing, you know. I'm sure that body changes is part of it.
But if we don't think moms are sexy simply because
that body made a person,
then why are we so appalled when mothers do look sexy? For example, remember when Kim Kardashian broke the internet a few years ago when she posed nude for the cover of Paper magazine? Twitter exploded with negative comments asking why she would do a nude photo shoot now that she'd become a mom. Whether you're a fan of Kardashian or not, when you think about it, she came under fire for presenting the same image that had made her famous to begin with. So where did we get the idea that something intrinsically should change about a woman as soon as she has a baby in her arms? This question led me to Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Washington State and bestselling author of a book on the history of marriage. With the help of Kuntz, I hoped I could trace the beliefs battling out in the public sphere, as well as in my own head, to their historical origins. I half expected Kuntz to tell me that religion was the source of the problem, end of story. After all, I know the time I spent at a Catholic Sunday school growing up didn't exactly help me develop a well-adjusted attitude towards sex. But Kuntz, as well as other historians and sociologists I talked to, agreed that religion wasn't the source so much as a tool to impose the prevailing ideas of any given time period.
There's a very strong tradition of religious control over women. Sexuality is a very good, powerful way to control people's personal behavior. And if you invest it with high morality, that's something that has a strong influence on people.
Now I'm going to share a quick historical timeline that Kuntz led me through of how women and mothers' sexuality has been under control over the years and how it evolved into the idea that all mothers should be chaste and self-sacrificing. We'll start in ancient Greece, a breeding ground for patriarchal beliefs.
You have to ensure that no man plants a seed in the row that you have hoed. And in many societies that really emphasize private property and inheritance, there is extreme concern with protecting the, quote, virtue, unquote, of women, so that you may be sure that you don't introduce, quote, a foreigner into the soil of the patrimonial family.
Hold it right there. In case you're feeling the weight of the patriarchy bearing down on you, there are other models from the past as well. In fact, from what Kuntz and other historians have gathered, many of our foraging ancestors likely had much more egalitarian configurations. Hunting together and then sharing the kill while it was fresh just made common sense. And in these hunter-gatherer societies, the women often provided a higher percentage of the overall food, making them highly valued members of the tribe. Kuntz said many of these tribes were likely non-monogamous as well, because in a setting where everything was shared, including parenting duties, there wasn't a strong need to emphasize paternity. While most hunter-gatherer societies existed more than 10,000 years ago, there are more recent examples to draw from.
There are many examples where we do not have the extreme jealousy and guarding of women's reproductive rights that you see in so many agricultural societies and in some hunting societies as well. There's a wonderful account of living with the Montagnais Naskapi Indians by a Jesuit, and he noted that although most women stayed home with their children when the men went out on long hunting forays, some women went out with them. And he thought that this was just absolutely terrible because they were out on their own with the men. And also he pointed out that even the ones that stayed home had a lot more freedom than women back in old Europe. And so at one point he has a discussion with this Naskapi, in what we would call today his informant, you know, in anthropological terms. And he says, "Now, you've got to keep your women at home because they're not as strong." And the Naskapi says, "Well, actually, they, you know, help us move the tents. They're very strong." And so then he picks another reason. "Well, they're not very wise." And the Naskapi says, "You know, we rely on the words of old women. Old women do not fling their words about without meaning." And so finally, he pulls out his big argument from the European perspective. "Well, if you allow women such freedom, how do you know that the children she bears will belong to you?" And the Naskapi Indian replies, "Thou hast no sense. We love all the children of the tribe. You Frenchmen love only the children of your body, but we love all the children of the tribe."
Another example is in a handful of tribal societies in South America.
Probably the most shocking example I can give you to modern day Americans is among the Bari of Venezuela and several other small scale groups. There's a belief that any man who sleeps with a woman during the course of her pregnancy contributes something of himself to her child. And so when the woman has the baby, the midwife says, "Name every lover you have had during your pregnancy." And if she names more than the one man who is her actual husband, the midwife goes to each of those men and says, "You have become a father." Now, here's what's so interesting. Today in our society, this would be the stuff of a Jerry Springer, you know, knockdown, dragout fight.
Right.
But it was one of the best assurances that a child would survive until adulthood, because men took that responsibility seriously and contributed a portion of their fishing and hunting to the child of the woman that they had slept with during her pregnancy.
But for the most part, when foraging tribes gave way to agrarian societies, Kuntz said the prevailing attitude became similar to the ancient Greeks.
"No man plants a seed in the row that you have hoed."
Having this attitude has made it easier for men to control their bloodline and to pass along land ownership for the past 10,000 years. Now that you've gotten some background on our foraging past, we'll fast forward to the medieval days. During this time period, and actually all the way up to the 1700s,
women were considered the lusty sex, more prone to sexual error and adventure than men. They were not considered naturally virtuous and naturally asexual.
Kuntz explained that at that time, men and women worked on the farm together. So it made sense that men had this view of women because they were around to keep them under control. Kuntz said this attitude continued through the colonization of the U.S. and into the late 1700s. If this is starting to feel like a boring history lesson, hang in there. We've just arrived at the critical moment where women were suddenly zapped of their sexuality. The Industrial Revolution was in full swing by the early 1800s, and with it, men began to work outside the home. It follows that if men considered their women to be lusty and not to be trusted, they'd have a hard time leaving them home alone and to their own devices. By insisting that women be asexual guardians of the home, men could head out to work without any worries. At the same time, the love marriage began gaining popularity.
People were terrified by it. They said, "If you marry for love, how will you get men to keep controlling their wives? If they love them, they might give in to them. How will you get a woman to marry the right person who her father wants her to marry? What will prevent her from running off with some inappropriate man? And how in the world will we prevent people from demanding the right to divorce a woman to leave a husband who doesn't treat her with love?"
This only reinforced the idea that women must be pure and asexual as a sort of coping mechanism for men.
This is when you get the idea of the male breadwinner, the female nurturer. And women became redefined as basically asexual or pure.
Kuntz said motherhood only added to this idea of men and women being opposites.
It's really not until this new love match ideal of the late 18th century that you get this idea that it's motherhood that makes a woman totally pure. And of course, the contradiction that we tend to forget how she got to be a mother in the first place.
Since mostly white middle-class women were actually able to stay home and fulfill this vision of domesticity, perhaps the most devastating consequences of this new view is what it did to poor women.
If she's a woman who has to work in the fields, if she's a black woman, a minority, a working class woman, then she has actually forfeited her claim to true womanhood. And so men could go to her as a prostitute.
This attitude also wreaked havoc on married couples' sex lives.
And one of the interesting things that happened to men's sexuality is that many of them could not have a sexual relationship with their wife in the same way that they could with a prostitute. I read a letter that a man wrote to Marie Stopes, who was one of the first women who wrote a sexual advice book at the early 20th century. And he said, "I am so thankful that you wrote this book, because before you wrote it, I would not have dared to express any of these kinds of sexual actions or behaviors to my wife for fear that she would think I was thinking she was a prostitute." So men got this tremendous diversification between good women and bad women, just as women did.
Meanwhile, women were beginning to suffer from extreme sexual frustration. Jen Haylett, a professor of sociology at the University of Iowa, who I also interviewed for this episode, said women began flocking to the doctor's office for relief.
These women are going to doctors with essentially all of this sexual repression that's built up and frustration, and doctors are finding ways to alleviate that pressure essentially by like bringing them to orgasm, you know? So acknowledging their sexuality, but doing it in a way that's sort of clinical and not really about pleasure, and then putting them back into their sphere at home where they then assume this identity that seems almost asexual again.
And wow, really? I didn't know
that. It's really interesting.
What would they be saying that they were solving for them? Sexual repression? So or would they not frame it that way?
No, they wouldn't frame it that way. Sometimes this is when people would talk a lot about like hysteria. So they would say that it could be something like that. It could just be related to like pelvic pain or discomfort. They wouldn't talk about it in explicitly sexual terms.
The feminist movement began upending many of these ideas in the late 19th and 20th centuries, but some of these notions haven't fully disappeared. In fact, Haylett had a theory that while women overall are in many ways liberated today, we still haven't relinquished control over mothers.
Maybe we've come to a point where women without children are seen as independent beings, and we very much believe in freedom and independence for individuals. So we let those women kind of do what they want. But then once they have kids, once there's a reason to or a justification for looking at those women as no longer independent or solely as individuals anymore, we like quickly latch on to that because we have this desire to still kind of control women's sexuality. And I think when they have kids, it's almost like a door opens where people all of a sudden feel, okay, now we can justify judging them because they're no longer, I guess, like complete individuals anymore. But it's interesting we don't do that with men, right? I don't really see men being called out in the same way for any of their behaviors pre or post having a child.
While I'm all in favor of mothers being liberated from this judgment, I found myself struggling with the question, is it harmful to your kids if you look sexy around them? The most insightful opinion I got on the matter came from Lena Maria Murillo, a professor of gender studies at the University of Iowa, who, apart from studying the matter, is also having an ongoing conversation about it in her household with her husband and two young daughters.
Society is incredible at manipulating children's minds from a very early age into thinking not only what is gender appropriate, but what is age appropriate.
At age 9 and 7, Murillo's daughters already have strong feelings that sexy is something their mom should not be.
They're just like, "Mom, can you button? You know, you need to button your shirt all the way up." They have friends of theirs who are already telling their parents, like, mom, don't do that. That's embarrassing. You know, that whole like, oh, mom, please. It's so embarrassing. And I'm like, don't even try that with me.
Mario said she's also had to defend the way she presents herself to her husband.
You know, we both grew up Catholic, and his family's very conservative. And it was the same thing. You know, it's just like, you're a mother now. And I was like, I am, but I'm not dead. And I enjoy expressing myself through clothing, through jewelry, through, I think it's a wonderful way to express your identity, your imagination, and your body. It may not look great by the ideals that we have today about, you know, the super fit body, the soup, like the yoga body, whatever. But I like what I look like. And so, yes, I tell my children, like, no, I'm keeping the button where it is.
In essence, Mario says that kids all go through the process of realizing that their parents are real human beings with lives of their own, and that respecting their sexual autonomy should simply be a part of that. While that process is never going to be comfortable for parents or for kids, she says that doesn't mean it's unhealthy. As funny as Mario's stories are about her run-ins with her daughters, she's making the best of a somewhat frustrating situation where she has to defend her behavior to her family and to the outside world.
Because they'll love to have that conversation in public with, like, other people. Yeah, no, where they'll just call me out. They're like, mom, that button's really low. And there's like seven other people there. And I'm like, it's fine.
This fits in with a phenomenon Kuntz pointed out. Unlike past time periods where there was a very clear model of motherhood, in today's world, women no longer have one ideal of motherhood to follow. Instead, they face conflicting models, and whichever one they choose, they end up having to defend to the world around them.
Most modern women feel guilty whatever they do. If they stay home, they say, oh my gosh, am I setting a bad role model for my daughter? You know, what am I going to do in the future? If they go out to work, they think, oh, am I being a bad mother? And people don't like feeling ambivalent. It's hard to admit ambivalence. It's hard to admit that I don't like half of what I'm doing. And so one very common psychological response to it is to blame the other, to project the part of you that you don't like onto somebody else so that you can say, well, the people who stay home are blah, 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 if you're a worker, or if you're a stay-at-home mom, the people who are working are neglecting their kids. And I think that it becomes more intense among women precisely because we are the victims, so to speak, of this incredible cross-cutting set of pressures.
Kuhn said we have to develop our own models of what we want motherhood to look like. And this brings me back to Satira. Satira kept performing all the way up until she was 32 weeks pregnant. When I talked to her just days before she gave birth to her son, here's what she had to say about what she expected life to be like post-pregnancy.
I want all women to know that pregnancy and motherhood is sexy. And, you know, you don't have to let this part of your life take away something that you once had. I know I'm going to be exhausted and I'm probably going to be covered in poop and I've not washed my hair for 2 weeks. But if I could just remember that I am still sexy on the inside, then I'm sure that other people will see it too whenever I do take a shower.
It's been a year since I had that conversation with Satira. I checked in with her a couple of weeks ago to see how her expectations of motherhood measured up to reality. She responded to my email right away and let me know that she returned to burlesque 9 weeks after giving birth to baby Declan. She spent the first few months facing challenges, such as having to pump breast milk backstage and get used to the changes to her body, which she said has made her a huge believer in high-waisted thongs. She said Declan comes backstage sometimes and loves when she gets all fancy with her glitter lips. He also enjoys pulling off her fake eyelashes. Satira is booking shows less frequently than before having Declan, but says she feels as sexy as ever, while admittedly a little tired. So where does this leave my relationship to motherhood? Have I worked through any of my hangups around having kids? The answer is yes and no. There are still so many aspects of motherhood that terrify me. The process of giving birth, the profound responsibility, and the leap of faith required as you jump into the unknown. But those are all podcast topics for another day. Talking to Kuntz and the other experts I interviewed for this episode, I was fascinated to tie beliefs that felt so stifling and personal to me back to such impersonal and unromantic purposes, essentially private property and inheritance. Knowing where these beliefs come from and seeing how little they make sense in today's world does make them lose some of their power. Now, when I think of myself with a child, I see myself less as this one-dimensional Madonna figure and more as a multifaceted human being, just like I am today, but with motherhood as a new facet to add to that collection. I'm Donna Cleveland, and this has been the second episode of Women and Radio, a podcast that explores the forces shaping women's lives. A big thanks goes out to my cousin Chosie Titus for designing my logo and creating the artwork for this episode, Mira Oberdijk for the theme song and other music sprinkled throughout the episode, Cody Olivas for the recording help, and part two on motherhood and sexuality is coming soon, where I'll explore how one woman broke free of the good mom trap and how that's made all the difference in her life. Before I go, I have a big favor to ask you. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe through the Apple Podcasts app and leave a review. That will help other people who might enjoy the show as well find it. If you have a story you'd like to see featured in a future episode, please email me at podcast@womenandradio.com. See you soon.